I have the pleasure of sharing with you the audio from a recent event with Professor Guy Biner. Guy is the author most recently of a book called Forgetful Remembrances. It's published by Oxford University Press and has won a myriad of awards. We had the pleasure of hosting Guy here at Luxman Ireland House a week ago last Thursday, and I'm delighted to share with you his introduction by Professor Kenny and then into Guy himself. Enjoy.
As I think most of you know, my name is Kevin Kenny. I'm the director of Glaxman Ireland House, and we're kicking off the spring season of public events. Water we have. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Guy Biner this evening. Guy is Professor of History at Ben-Gurion University, received his PhD at University College Dublin. I don't know Guy very well, and yet I feel that we are old friends. It's partly because I know your work very well. It's partly because we first encountered each other at a conference in London on the idea of diaspora, which I was just learning about, and Guy gave me a really hard time from the audience, which was really helpful. That's how academic discourse works. I learned a lot from that exchange. Guy is spending the current academic year at Boston College, my old stomping ground, as a Burns scholar. In addition to numerous articles, essays, and book chapters, he's the author of two important books, Remembering the Year of the French, Irish Folk History and Social Memory, published in 2007, winner of numerous awards. And in 2018, Guy published his magnum opus, at least to date, Forgetful Remembrance, Social Forgetting and Vernacular Historiography of a Rebellion in Ulster, the Rebellion in Ulster, the 98, which will provide the basis of his lecture this evening. Again, a winner of multiple prizes. We'll have one copy of the book on display this evening. I'm keeping mine. The book, there are flyers that are providing an academic discount, and perhaps most tangibly, this heavy book will come out in paperback very soon. So, Forgetful Remembrance is a landmark work in Irish history and in the field of memory studies more generally. So you'll forgive me if I offer a slightly longer introduction than usual, not simply because at 709 pages it's a slightly longer book than usual, but also because it's one of the most important books in Irish history you are likely to read. Pierre Nora and others pioneered the field known as History of Memory, in which historians examine the relationship, among other things, between history as it is written down and history as it is remembered. But Guy takes as his starting point the fundamental insight that any act of remembering is necessarily selective, and therefore also an act of forgetting. It is this emphasis on forgetting that marks the book's most important contribution to the field of memory studies. Forgetful Remembrance is a total history of the process that Guy calls social forgetting, the process by which a community, in seeking to suppress uncomfortable knowledge about its past, paradoxically ensures that the discomfort and the knowledge will persist, even if the supposedly forgotten memories cannot be articulated coherently or stated publicly, or if they're the subject at times of systematic suppression by the community or the state. The social forgetting of this kind, he emphasizes, is not collective amnesia. The act of forgetting ensures that something is remembered, even if it has no form or expression. And at one point, Guy uses the simple but brilliant analogy of a judge who rules that testimony just delivered in the courtroom is not admissible as evidence, and the jury must disregard it. And this attempt at suppression ensures that the testimony will be remembered, even if it cannot be used. Now, unlike most historians in the field, Guy is interested not in lieux de mémoire, or sites of memory, but in what he calls lieux de oubli, or sites of forgetting. To penetrate this world of social forgetting, he moves away from meaning as found in formal academic history and toward what he refers to in his subtitle as vernacular historiography, the past as remembered and relived at a social or popular level. And this approach is similar to a range of others he discusses in his introduction. The introduction, by the way, is worth the price of the book. It tells you everything you could possibly need to know about the subject of memory. Approaches like history from below, people's history, subaltern history, popular history, public history. What Guy is doing is similar to that, but not quite the same. His book tries to get behind the scenes in communities that forget or try to forget episodes from their past. It's a brilliant approach, and it succeeds spectacularly. But if vernacular historiography as a way of remembering or forgetting the past stands in sharp contrast to the kind of historical knowledge produced by academics and universities, that raises another paradox, and to me a very pleasing one. Guy's subject is the vernacular, but he analyzes that subject with all the tools of the most rigorous academic historian. In other words, he gives us an academic history at its finest of this kind of memory and forgetting. Towards the end of the book, Guy opens out onto other sensitive episodes in Irish history, including the Troubles, and briefly considers a range of subjects around the world, from the Holocaust to Vichy France, the bombing of German cities, from the Armenian Genocide to the collapse of communism and the legacies of empires. These are big, controversial subjects, and as Guy declares, with what I take to be a mixture of modesty and threat, unsatisfied readers are therefore invited to take the book apart and rewrite it anew. Forgetful Remembrance is a beautiful and profound book. Vernacular historiography, as Guy concludes, makes it evident that people have always spoken, even in whispers, about their past. The old question, can the subaltern speak, he concludes, is the wrong question. The real question to be asked, to quote the last line of the book, is, can the historian listen? Guy.
I might be wandering around, and if people can't hear me, I'll return to the mic, but I often wander around and I speak loud, so hopefully everybody will hear, but if there's any indication that's not working, then I'll speak from here. All right, so we'll see how that goes. I'm a bit dumbfounded by that introduction because I always caution my children that I believe people shouldn't see a trailer before they see a movie. You've just had the best of the lecture given to you, delivered, including the conclusions and everything. So now I'm just spelling it out. You've already seen all the pieces. And actually, I'm going to disappoint you because the trailer shows it in the best way. And afterwards you say, well, you could have cut that out and changed that. And it's not what I expected. You just saw the trailer of what I'm going to do. What I'm going to talk about tonight, with your permission, is I'll talk about the book. I've been giving talks on topics related to the book, but each time I chose a specific theme. This time, I'm enjoying the fact that I was invited to Glucksmann House, which is this great powerhouse of Irish history and Irish studies in New York and in North America and on a global scale, and wasn't asked to give a topic, just speak about the book. So I'll speak about the book, and if this is the cover of the book and that's its title, what I'll be doing is trying to break out exactly this notion of social forgetting and explaining it. Now, Irish historians, more than Irish history, I would say, have a certain notoriety for not willing to engage with theory. It's a stereotype, which I'm willing to contest, but every stereotype has a large grain of truth to it as well. Well, not every, but quite a few do have. And in this case, I'm going to have to explain a theoretical term, which I'm introducing here. But the best way, I believe, to explain this theoretical term is through a case study. And I'll show the case study, the main case study of the book. And hopefully we'll all understand exactly what I mean by social forgetting afterwards. And hopefully, just as Kevin mentioned, I think this is a powerful tool which you can apply to other areas of Irish history and to other areas of other histories. So hopefully we'll all leave this room empowered with some kind of prism or a lens, or maybe just picking up on things which are obvious to you anyway. I'm not too sure that it's that radical at all. So let's look through it. I found it useful in this case to go back and look at, it's stated there, the Great Irish Rebellion of 1798, often referred to in Irish popular history or historical consciousness simply as the 98. Certain dates, like the 45 in Scotland, they just stand out. We know, when you mention 98, that it's 1798. An event which in many ways, some people would argue, it's an interpretation, has cast long shadows on Irish history, on Irish politics. And we're still playing out some of these politics in various ways. So it's an interesting point, because quite often when we take studies of memory, we follow the history of memory over a period. If we, for example, look at the case of the Troubles, we can follow the history of the Troubles. There's 50 years now to the Troubles. We've got a historical perspective, but we only have 50 years. In the case of 1798, it's more than 200 years. We can follow the story and see how it develops over time. So there's a certain advantage to looking at the event in the late 18th century, which is well documented, unlike earlier events, or certain earlier events, and we can follow the history of that memory. Now, if we're interested in the memory of 1798, a good starting point would be by a historian who's commented a lot, a key text for the memory of 1798. That would be Kevin Whelan. Kevin Whelan has this remarkable line in a great essay, 98 After 98, The Politics of Memory, in which he notes, "The rebellion never passed into history because it never passed out of politics." It's a remarkable statement. So people are constantly replaying this politics. So we don't have this separation, the separation between that's memory and this is history, and the two are separated. History is looking at it dispassionately, as if we're always engaging with this point. Now, usually these arguments are made about what would be considered the main arena of the rebellion of 1798. And its main arena would be the southeast, would be particularly County Wexford, but also Wicklow and Kildare. That would be, for many people, the main arena, particularly County Wexford of 1798. A lot has been written about that, and there are strong traditions of memorialization there. On purpose, by the way, the images here, I'm looking at images which are later than the event themselves on purpose. We can see how this is being reflected later. So these are nationalist illustrations, in this case 90 years later, by J.D. Ray. John Ray was the star illustrator of one of the key nationalist journals of the late 19th century, the Stamrock. Also for a few other newspapers and magazines, depiction of the Battle of Ullard Hill. So we see here a scene from Wexford. And quite often this is talked about as collective memory. I don't like the term collective memory. I can live with it in this case. I don't like it that much. It has some problems. It would take me a seminar to explain why, but in general I'd say two points I have with a good deal of the work. I think the more sophisticated work takes this on board very well. But the image, the connotation we have when we say collective memory is first of all of homogeneity, that a community remembers collectively. There's always contestations. There's always various forms of memory competing against each other. And the other point which we need to think about quite often in national studies of collective memory is this notion of top-down memory, that there's an elite which configures memory and everybody passively accepts that. I'd contest that. When I did engage with these issues, I chose on purpose to move away from Wexford, which is so politically contested. And I looked at it in the previous book. I went and looked at the west of Ireland, at Connacht, at the French invasion, the small French invasion in the very end of the rebellion, in the late summer of 1798, into the autumn, in August, September. Here's another picture by J.D. Ray of the Castlebar races, the races of Castlebar, which entered into Irish kind of nationalist mythology as this kind of victory, chasing away troops. It was a very small victory, but it was significant in the way it was remembered. And here, I used particularly folklore sources, particularly in Irish language. And I found that the term which would be more appropriate would be social memory. Because of these contestations, because of these various stories that are coming around, it was hard to speak of a collective memory. There were many local, a patchwork of local memories, which were competing against each other, various family traditions. And were meeting each other, and through that, they were also negotiating their own identity in opposition to what was happening in Wexford, in opposition to what was coming from Dublin. So a provincial community has its own way of speaking with it. So I talked about social memory or social remembrance even better than memory, because it's a verb, it's a process. And we can see examples of that clear startling examples. There's a long tradition of commemorating 1798 in Wexford, and even in Connacht. So I'm just showing here as examples the famous pikeman statues. These are statues, in this case, a statue designed by Oliver Shepherd, the famous sculptor. This is from Wexford town, the pikemen going out to march from the centenary. The foundation stone is in centenary. The statue is slightly a bit later. Or, in this case, a statue in French Hill, just outside Castle Bar. And you can notice the difference here, because here you can see the engagement with folklore much more clearer. Outside Castle Bar, connected to the battle, but not part of the battle, there was a small skirmish. It's not mentioned in historical accounts, but local folklore identified the site as a place where French soldiers had died and were buried there. And for years, the place was known as French Hill. And then some 70 years later, people decided to check, verify local tradition. And they dug into the ground and found skeletons with blue uniform, which was decaying. So they set up a monument there. So here we see kind of a different process. It's not coming from above. It's coming from below and being negotiated in a language which corresponds to what's happening elsewhere. And yet it's being rededicated for the centenary. The monument was 20 years before the centenary. So that's just a quick word. But I start with these examples because all of this is happening. These forms of commemoration are happening in the public sphere. We're missing here the top here. It's being cut. But it's commemoration in the public. But what happens with memory behind closed doors? What happens in private spheres? And this is where I want to look and explore the notion of social forgetting. And for that, I'd like to look at another arena. This is a remarkable thing about the rebellion of 1798. It has different arenas, and they're distinct. And there's also different forms of memorialization afterwards. So as histories of memory, they're remarkable as a case study to look at different forms of memory. So let's look at the Northeast. The Ulster provinces of Antrim and Down and adjacent parts of Derry, Londonderry. What can we say about that? Well, let's start first of all by saying a few words about 1798 for those who don't know and its connection to the North, to Ulster. The society behind the 1798 rebellion, what happens afterwards on the ground is a much more complicated story, but the society which conspires for this rebellion is the Secret Society of the United Irishmen. And the Secret Society of the United Irishmen, which on a continental scale could be seen as an Irish variant of a Jacobin club, if you wish, for those who know continental history, inspired by the French Revolution, inspired by the revolution in America, in many ways, its heartland, its cradle, more than its heartland, its cradle was in the Northeast, around Belfast, which would later be called the Athens of the North. Now, how do you know that? It's difficult as an historian to trace a secret society because they're secret, right? How do you check a history of any secrets? But there's many ways of doing that. But one way, for example, that I'm just showing here, which I wanted to show you graphically how we could do it, is by looking, for example, at the distribution of their radical newspaper, which was suppressed. The original radical newspaper, the Northern Star, printed in Belfast, and its distribution was largely in the Northeast, exactly in these kind of areas, which we'll talk about in a minute. More than that, we want to talk of a founding moment, a mythical moment in Irish political history, founding moment of Irish republicanism, if we wish. It's the moment in the memoirs of Theobald Wolfe Tone, the man who will later be known as the father of Irish republicanism. He wasn't called that in 1798, and he wasn't necessarily the most important United Irishman either, but that's how memory will work. Theobald Wolfe Tone recalls in his memoirs how he traveled in 1795 to Belfast, which was radical Belfast, to meet the United Irishmen. And together with local radicals, he climbs Cave Hill, that big hill overlooking Belfast. And they go up to MacArthur's Fort, this ancient fort. And he's meeting there with northern radicals, including Thomas Russell, who's actually a southerner, but he's living in the north at the time, Robert Sims, Henry Joy McCracken. And they're having a picnic. And in this picnic, he describes how they take a solemn oath never to desist their efforts until Ireland achieves independence. They separate Ireland from England and it achieves independence. It's a founding moment because that's remembered as the moment where this Secret Society of the United Irishmen, which started as a reform society, which was willing to engage with the authorities, that's the moment where it becomes a really radical revolutionary society. That's the moment where it's committed to a republican path fully. So it's an interesting moment, and this happens in Belfast. And I'm starting with that, because what's interesting here is also the profile of the United Irishmen in the North. the backbone of the movement, the original movement, was largely Presbyterian from Scottish background. These are the Ulster Scots, the Ulster Scots Presbyterians. And this is a key point. It's a key point. The United Irish Movement tried to bring together what was called at the time Protestants, Catholics, and Dissenters. Dissenters would be the Presbyterians. Protestants would be Church of Ireland and other forms of Protestantism. And even in the North, there would have been Presbyterians who joined together with Church of Ireland Protestants, quite a few significant people. Henry Monroe, the leader of the rebels later in County Down, was Church of Ireland. And they were joined with Catholics, famous Catholics like the Teeling family, Charles Hamilton Teeling or Bartholomew Teeling. But most of the United Irishmen in the North were Presbyterian. And this is interesting. Now, I'll explain in a minute why this is interesting for memory in particular, because that's the focus of what we have here now. So the first point to mention is, what happens with the rebellion in the North? You could read a lot of history books and they focus only on Wexford. They devote a page or a paragraph, a sentence to Ulster. And that's interesting in itself, because not only was there a rebellion in Ulster, there was a ferocious rebellion in Ulster. Thousands, tens of thousands of people rallied to the United Irish flag. And it's not a small thing, because this happens after the rebellion already broke out in Wexford and they saw how it was being suppressed terribly. This was after they were being told that in Wexford it's turning sectarian and there was government propaganda discouraging them to join with Catholics. It was when they were waiting for French aid, which failed to arrive. It only arrived later in Connacht. So against all odds, they turn out in this rebellion. We'll use the word turn out later. It's an interesting word. They turn out in rebellion in huge numbers. It's a short rebellion, but it's a massive event. If you look here, this is a map I took from Tony Stewart's brilliant book, Summer Soldiers. And you can see sites of rebellion all around Ulster. So it might last a week. There's other skirmishes afterwards. But this is a mass event of violence which supersedes the Troubles, which goes on for 30 years by far. So we're talking about an explosion of violence. With battles like the Battle of Antrim, the attempt to take over Antrim town, this is how it's recalled later in antiquarian print. This is a picture by John Carey. Carey used to specialize in antiquarian imagery for antiquarians, and he's drawing a book here for Robert McGill Young. Robert McGill Young wrote an antiquarian history of Belfast, of the town of Belfast, and covered this issue. And here he asked for this sketch to depict the Battle of Antrim, or another famous battle. And here I'll refer to the big battle in County Down, the final big battle at Ballinahinch. And here we have a contemporary depiction. I want to go back and start. I've been showing you on purpose images from 100 years later. For a moment, let's go back to a contemporary depiction. Look at Robinson's depiction of the Battle of Ballinahinch. For those who are familiar with military painting, you might see what it's modeled on. It's modeled on Benjamin West's the Death of General Wolfe. Famous image, which was circulating around in different copies. So he's copying it here. It's clear that he was copying it. And he had to acknowledge it later. His critics were mentioning it already at the time. And this is, if you wish, the old adage of history is written by the victors. So the depiction of the victors, it's the military in the front, sustaining their casualties. The rebels are the biggest mass of people in the background. If you're pressed to look at it closely, you'll spot a green flag on the hill at the back there. It's a big blur of people. It's the victors are at the center of the story here. Sustained small casualties compared to the rebels. It's the rebels you want to hear, but it's hard to see them in the picture here. Even though there is one rebel over here. This man over here, Hugh McCullough, is being dragged to be hanged on a windmill. You can identify this moment. And it's an interesting moment because his brother is fighting with the military, with the crown. So it's also a civil war, which is also an interesting event, which we might think about a little bit more. But why am I starting with this image? Because you can see thousands and thousands of people from the area are participating in this battle. However, something will happen. The rebellion is brutally suppressed. That's also, by the way, one of the myths. It's thought that because there was a large group of Protestants there, that the authorities treated them with leniency. In fact, when you compare executions and court-martials, this is the most brutally suppressed arena of 1798. There's a gruesome chapter in the book which deals with that, but it's gruesome stuff. The lashings, the hangings, the court-martials. But when we go back to it, and I'll ask about its implications about memory and forgetting, because you can't forget these kind of things. And the government was trying to make people forget it in a way, and you can't forget it in its own policy. However, when you return to that, what's interesting is what follows. In the years after 1798, the policy of the government, William Pitt Jr., the son's policy, is to pass the Act of Union. Ireland can't be allowed to stay this rebellious area during the Great Wars with France, which will turn afterwards into the Napoleonic Wars. And so, the Act of Union, which was passed in the following 2 years, something interesting happens there. We create this new unit, which we live with its legacy till today, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, as it was at the time. Now it's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland for the moment. Nothing's clear anymore now. But when we look at this, something interesting happens in terms of the politics of memory. Because at this moment, there's an attempt to win over these Presbyterian radical communities and bring them in. Catholics are promised emancipation. They don't get full emancipation. They'll have to wait for Daniel O'Connell a couple of decades later. But Presbyterians get full rights under the Union. And there's a sway and there's a change, not as quick as it might seem, but it's a process. But the process will happen that these communities, which to a large extent, to the Civil War, many of them also fought on the side of the Crown, but to a large extent, these were radical areas, the heartland of, or the cradle, as I described before, of the United Irish Movement, will later turn from republicanism towards loyalism, unionism, and in some cases also orangism. So they're realigning their political allegiances. They're changing, shifting 180 degrees. And this is interesting. So if you return to the same site of Ballinahinch some years late into the 19th century, you won't be seeing people in public commemorating 1798 and their participation in the rebellion. You'll see this. You'll see orange marches. You'll see people parading and recalling and celebrating the, not the participation of Protestants together with Catholics in a rebellion against the crown, but an interpretation of the late 17th century of a battle which is perceived in local memory as Protestants against Catholics. And this is interesting. And this will continue, this history. So over here you'll see people who in this case are the children of the rebels. But it's really the rebels themselves in the first generation who began switching. So former rebels had to quickly, one way to redeem yourself in the new dispensation was to join the Orange Order. And to become from a croppy, to become a rebel within overnight. By committing perjury as well, because you had to take an oath that you never was a member of a secret organization. And you took it because that was your way of starting a new life. You have to think about what that means in terms of memory in a minute. But their children will also not celebrate or mark or commemorate or memorialize in public the actions of their parents and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. So if you go over today, you'll see the same scenes. Orange marches. And in fact, follow the base. Where are the big orange parades? Particularly in these areas which were the areas of the United Irishmen. More than that, if you look at politics, this is the stronghold now of the DUP in many places. If you look at local elections, so it's quite remarkable. People who are now identified as strongly loyalist with this Republican, in a late 18th century sense, it's different from today's republicanism, skeleton in their closet. We have to think about that. So they're not so much engaged with remembering 98 as we saw in the West and in the Southeast. One could argue that what they're doing is engaging in disremembering. Now I'm going to pause with this point here, disremembering. If you don't hear me, I'll go back to the mic. But let me know. Because when I use a term like disremembering, it sounds like here I'm becoming theoretical again. I'm using fancy language. I'm using kind of postmodernisms here. This is what I want to kind of hint to what I mean by vernacular historiography. Disremember is a local term. If you look at glossaries of dialect as it was used in Antrim and Down, up until not that long ago, you'll find this is from the 19th century. It's used as a word to signify to forget. People would use the word disremember. So I'm using on purpose a local term here, to disremember. And we'll return to that term in a minute. Now we could use, when we try to step back at this and diagnose this academically, as Kevin said, we have to see how we apply academic tools to this kind of vernacular language which we see there. We could say that what we have here is collective amnesia. Just like I don't like the term collective memory, I don't like the term collective amnesia. Again, we have this image that it's collective, that it's simply manipulated. It's manipulated to a large extent, but it's completely malleable. You can switch it on and off. We can just switch off memory. I don't accept that. And I want to propose that the term we should use here, and I'll explain it in greater detail, even though you've been given all the nuggets already, is social forgetting. Now let's look at that for a minute. And part of the key would be, already in the definitions picked up by folklorists, antiquarians who looked at what, when they asked people, what do you mean by saying the word disremember? So disremember could be to forget, to be unable to recall. But it could also mean to pretend to forget, be unwilling or inclined not to remember. That's a nice little Irish phrase, isn't it? Be inclined or unwilling not to remember. So something interesting is going on there. We need to figure this one out. Here we see it there. Let's just focus on that for a moment. And through that, I propose, as already Kevin gave you the synopsis already, I propose that let's look at social forgetting. Let's first of all define what we mean. There's many different forms of forgetting. So social forgetting, I'm going to propose as a definition by saying social forgetting occurs when a community tries to suppress or ignore embarrassing events in its past. Now, every community invariably has its dark secrets. Every country has it, every nation. Ernest Renan, the famous Breton philosopher, gave a lecture already in the late 19th century in France where he reminded French people that they have dark secrets in their closets in the late 19th century. Every country, every event, there are events which we don't celebrate and don't commemorate. So how do we deal with them? And the point that I'd like to make is that when you try, as Kevin already mentioned, when you try to disregard these events, to disremember these events, they don't simply disappear. We mark them to be forgotten. So what we have is not total amnesia. We have something else. It's not pressing delete on your computer and it disappears. I'm not arguing that there's no such thing as total memory, total forgetting. On the contrary, I'd argue that most of history was completely forgotten. Most of the events that happened throughout history have been completely forgotten. We have no idea about them and we'll never know about them ever. They've been completely forgotten. But since they've been completely forgotten, I have little to say about them. We have no traces of them. This is something else. Let's see what happens when people try to forget something and what happens when we lift the bonnet and look under the hood there for a minute. What actually happens? What are the mechanics that are at play? And I'd argue that what happens is we might find, not always, but we might find, the digger we deep, various practices of remembering in private circumstances, less public circumstances. They could even be very public, but not that outsiders wouldn't always pick up on them. They'd have this image that it's been forgotten. Now, I'm slightly hesitant to talk about this because I know that Hasia Diner has dealt with this in another context. So there's a whole book about forgetting where you've shown another myth of forgetting very strongly. So I'm a bit afraid to do this in your presence. All right, so I'm saying that in advance, just putting my cards here on the table. I'm treading very carefully here. It's easier for me to speak about Ulster. But the notion is that I'm interested in the tensions between this facade, let's call it, this notion that we have this impression of public oblivion and the persistence of recollections in private. So we have here muted recollections, which are suppressed and talked about quietly in various forms, often not that quietly, but we don't hear them necessarily, we don't see them immediately, as opposed to reticence. Now, reticence is an interesting thing here, and this is where Ulster is a particularly interesting place to study, even though I think a study of reticence in Ireland, and Margaret, who's here, would be the expert on this. A study of reticence in Ireland is waiting to be written, a history of silence in Ireland, because we like to talk about oral history. We haven't even begun to talk about silences. But in this case, Ulster is particularly interesting, because if Ireland has the stereotype, again, stereotypes, of the gift of the gab, Ulster has a different stereotype, of kind of being tight-lipped. The person who captured it best, many people have captured it, would probably be Seamus Heaney. Seamus Heaney, that wonderful poem, "Whatever you say, say nothing." That already is a good depiction of social forgetting. "Whatever you say, say nothing," which is, of course, also the title of a ballad by Colin Sands, popular ballad, very funny ballad. But think of these lines where he talks about northern reticence, the tight gag of place. Oh, land of password, hand grip, wink and nod. So there's different ways to communicate messages, which are not necessarily that verbal or that vocal. Where tongues like coiled, there's whispering morse. So how do you do a history of that? That's the interesting point. And again here, just to kind of bring it together, so I'd say social forgetting, which I've described what it tries to do, what it actually does in practice, it's sustained through tensions between public oblivion and these muted forms of remembrance in private spheres. These tensions are what sustain it. We have to look at that and see how we do a history of that. That's our challenge. This is the big problem, which is an historian we have to deal with methodologically. All right, but that's where we're going to find social forgetting. And just to explain the paradox here, that means that social forgetting is actually a form of social remembrance. It's a form of memory through forgetting. Okay, so we're full of paradoxes here. We've gone through the looking glass here. So we're going to enjoy that for a minute. Just to add a few things here. So if our task is to uncover this hidden, secret history, I don't like these terms. In history, we love to say, I'm dealing with a hidden history, with a secret history. Secret to who? Hidden to who? You begin looking around it, it's all over. But we have this image that it's secret, that it's hidden. But how do we deal with it? For that, we have to move away from history with a capital H and look exactly to what I call vernacular history. We have to look at all the other sources that are around. And that's the other challenge of the book, vernacular history, even vernacular historiography, because it develops over time. It has multiple sources. But we have to start, like always, with the archive, reading the archive against the grain, but then move outside of the archive and use folklore and any other source we can hang on to, not even textual sources. We need to use visual material and material objects. Let me give you an example of material objects just to show what I mean by vernacular history. So let's go back to the scene here, right? We've got here social forgetting, vernacular history. That's the procession. That's what you see in the public sphere. You see orange order marches every marching season. If you'd go to the houses and win the confidence now, you wouldn't be shown this immediately. You might discover something else. And this is just from the area here, around the general area here of County Down. Let's have a look at these images. These two gentlemen over on the left there, George and James Gray McCartney, late 19th century. It's a photograph of them outside their cottage, outside their house. I was warned yesterday, two weeks ago in Bloomington, to stop using the word cottage, and so I will. The great Henry Glassy himself told me that, so I will not do it anymore. Now, George and James Gray McCartney are holding on to artifacts of a local heroine of 1798, and they're holding on to their house. Let's look here on the side here. Sarah Connan, Portaferry, it's a bit further down south. She has this handkerchief of leaders of the United Irishmen. It's hanging on her wall. It's not hanging outside, but it's in the wall of a kitchen. Look at these people over here. Eddie Floyd, postman in Kirkcudbyn, not too far away from Ballinahinch. He's got swords, he's got a pistol from the battle, and he holds on to them. And he's the local postman. Mrs. Brown here, Miss Brown, she's widowed. Her son was in the RUC as a policeman. But she keeps weapons in the house. The pike and the cannonballs are in the house there. Oh, here's another pike of Wallace Mitchell from Corbett, another townland in the area. These are all Unionist households. These are Loyalist households, but they're keeping pikes of rebels from 1798. So how do we deal with that, these kind of memories that persist? All right? So to deal with that, you need to develop a whole new sensibility to vernacular historiography. And the great thing is this to me when I looked at this case, and that's why this case proved so rich and so fertile. And that's why it took 700 pages, which is a small part of the, you know, a lot was cut out. I have to remind my publisher constantly when they say, how did you do this to us? Yeah, a lot is cut out. More than two-thirds were cut out. Now, the key point is this. Ulster was also the most literate province in Ireland, outside of Dublin. And this is remarkable. So I had this remarkable trace, unlike when I was looking at traditions in Irish and Connacht and had to work with disparate sources in different periods. What I managed to find here, the more I dug, was that every few years, somebody would go around documenting local traditions. A local antiquarian, or a local minister, or a school teacher, or a traveler traveling by. Could be, again, tourists coming in and out, a writer, a poet. And once you've put all of these together in their different forms and their different genres, suddenly you have this historiography. Let me give you an example, a couple of examples of these kind of people who are not part of the canon of Irish historiography. And you want to write Irish historiography, they don't appear on the map, but they're remarkable. Let's look at this person over here for a minute. Samuel McSkimmon. Samuel McSkimmon, from the town of Carrickfergus, was a shopkeeper, known as an antiquarian in his day. He was, in fact, the most knowledgeable person in the first half of the 19th century on the history of Antrim. Anybody who wanted to know anything about Antrim would have to go to Carrickfergus to seek him out in the shop and interview him. In fact, when the Ordnance Survey was being conducted The surveyors went up to him, came to show him the place and tell him the stories behind the sites. He knew the stories of what was happening. Now, Samuel McKibben published his work in his History and Antiquities of the County and Town of Carrickfergus. When you read it, from ancient times up until the present day, first published in 1810, hardly mentions 98. Second edition comes out, a few more sentences, not mentioned. Didn't he know about 98? Well, the truth is that Samuel McKibben was obsessed with 1798, but he on purpose censored himself and couldn't bring himself to publish it in his history. Not only was he obsessed by it, he was haunted by it. Samuel McKibben came from a town further north in Antrim called Ballyclare, and he had to run away from Ballyclare because he was suspected or accused of being an informer. He denied the allegations. It doesn't help you if you're accused of being an informer. And he ran away to Carrickfergus, an informer against the United Irishmen. Carrickfergus was a garrison town. When he was there, he was obliged or expected to join the yeomanry, a paramilitary force helping the forces of the crown put down the rebellion. So he found himself being sent on missions which he felt highly uncomfortable with. In fact, on his deathbed, he told his most deepest secret, that the act which he could never forgive himself was that he was sent on one of these missions, on a kind of a counterinsurgency mission, to the village of Doak in County Antrim, where he had to destroy the local book club. That's where he had learned to read. That's where he had learned. He was a man of knowledge. He collected books all his life. He had to destroy those books. He could never forgive himself for that. So he had these things heavy on his chest. He'd write travel literature. It took me a while because it was under pseudonyms. It was supposedly anonymous, but you can trace him down. He wrote travel literature. And wherever he went, he was obsessed by finding memories of 1798. And he broke down. When he was shown graves, mass graves of rebels, he broke down crying, saying, "These are my friends. I knew these people." He would go around the countryside. He had a name for himself. Plying people with drink. Going to public houses. Selling them drink till they got drunk and getting them to sing songs and poems and stories about 1798. The whole of his life he dedicated to writing a history of 1798 that he couldn't publish. Now it comes out posthumously, and he doesn't even call it in the original edition. The title that he gave it was simply Annals of Ulster, Ireland 50 years ago. It doesn't mention 1798. And because he lived his whole life as a loyalist, he had to bury these traditions. While he was writing about them, he was hiding them. So the whole book is about showing that the rebellion was a bad thing, and hiding the traditions. He's not even using most of the material that he had. He's choosing it very collectively. But when you read it carefully, you find incredible gems there. For example, I love reading footnotes. So let's look at a footnote here on page 112. In speaking of this insurrection, it is rarely called a rebellion, but commonly the turnout, the call used at the time to those who appeared tardy to come forth to the ranks. So now we know. Sometimes as oral historians, we ask the wrong questions. We ask people, tell me a story about so-and-so, and you get nothing, because you're asking them about the wrong words. You have to know how to ask the question. Ask, tell me about the rebellion, you won't hear much. You could ask about the turnout. That's just one of many euphemisms that we used. Or as we learn from other sources, vernacular sources, it would be pronounced quite often the turnout. Ulster Scots dialect. So the turnout. And look how it's phrased. It's phrased in a way about people who are tardy. People were not all that tardy in 1798 to join the rebellion, but afterwards that's how it's described. It's talking about the rebellion at the same time saying they didn't really want to rebel. Let me give another example about how this is used. You'll pick up on this ambiguity, I hope. Let's look at this. Old Ballymena. Old Ballymena is a publication that came out of the Ballymena Observer, a town in mid-Antrim, loyalist town in the mid-19th century, extremely loyalist. The newspaper is a unionist newspaper. And they have this idea in the mid-19th century, let's collect a local history. Let's hear traditions from the area. And they specify nothing too political now, nothing too controversial. And they keep getting stories of 1798, but they don't want them. So they put them aside. They keep getting more, and they keep getting more. And in the end, it turns into a history of 1798, which they don't want to publish, but they publish it. More than half of it is about 1798. But how is it? How do you write about it in a safe way when you've got all these traditions? So you have to use these euphemisms and to couch them. So they just explain here. Again, the rebellion was very seldom spoken of as an insurrection. It was almost invariably designated a turnout. Because these misguided individuals went there, right? They were in the horns of a dilemma. They didn't know if to rebel or not. They were compelled to turn out. Were they compelled? They turned out in their tens of thousands wearing their Sunday best. But how do you deal with this later? Later, you have to describe it as reluctant rebels. They did this ambiguously. And this is how ambiguity plagues this whole notion. Social forgetting is always couched in ambiguity. That's quite interesting. So while you uncover it, you also cover it at the same time. Give some more examples. I thought I'd comment. I'm just touching on brief things, a few brief things here. I want to talk for a minute about the generation of forgetting. I like the word, I like the phrase, the generation of forgetting, because it's a double barrel, a double meaning word phrase. It works on two levels. One is to generate social forgetting. How is it generated? Another, of course, is the generation of those who lived through the events, the first generation. Through this book, I try to follow several generations. You have to start with that. I even start before that generation. That's a different point. But the generation of forgetting. So let's look at these two remarkable individuals. On your left there is Mary Ann McCracken, one of the most remarkable women in the history of Belfast. And here I'm going to do her an injustice and describe her as the sister of. She wasn't the sister of. She was a great woman in her own right, did remarkable things in Belfast. But she was also the sister of Henry Joy McCracken, the leader of the rebels in Antrim Town. We saw the picture before of Antrim Town, who was executed. And the rest of her life, she was devoted to his memory. She would always wear dark clothes. The shutters in her house were always closed, except for St. Patrick's Day. And this was a unionist household. She reconciled with the union. A liberal unionist household, all the same. But she remained a radical woman. And behind closed doors, she would gather the last United Irishmen who still survived, and they would talk about their stories and remember it all the time. People like the man on the right there, James Jemmy Hope, the working man's hero, who led a battalion of troops, a platoon of troops of United Irishmen at the Battle of Antrim, who was out with Robert Emmet later. Jemmy Hope would show up there, this working man's hero, and he would be part of this kind of small group which would talk around there. But they didn't publish their stories. So when did their stories come out? This is all quiet. The stories come out, of course, towards the end of their life. When people are afraid, what will happen? Will it go with them to the grave? They see that Samuel McSkimmon is going around collecting these stories, but they're afraid to trust him with them because they know what he's going to do with them. He's a loyalist. And they find a kindred spirit in Richard Robert Madden, a Catholic from Dublin. But they meet on a point of politics, of radical politics. Richard Robert Madden, remarkable historian, antiquarian, travel writer, colonial administrator, and an abolitionist. And as an abolitionist, that's where they meet. He's a great emancipator of slaves in various colonies in England, a great campaigner for that. And that's their politics as well, these radical politics. And they meet with that, and they trust them with his stories. In fact, he ghostwrites the autobiography of Jemmy Hope. Jemmy Hope comes to him, tells him the story, Madden writes it out for him and gives it to him, he approves it, they go back and forth over a series of interviews that goes on for years. And that's how we have the stories preserved, both in manuscript form and in a select published form, which is interesting. So here again, what is this generation of social forgetting? People keep the secret behind closed doors. They'll find various ways of dealing with it. But towards the end of their life, they'll experience what could be called, and I'm stealing a term here from the great Marianne Hirsch, but I also think it should be used in a different context. They experience a post-memory anxiety. What will happen after they die? Who will keep these memories alive? And that's how they trust. And that's why it can emerge into the open. But even then, guided, carefully, deposited to the right person, certain secrets are not divulged. That's the key point. And we could follow, and I don't really have time here because I've been going on, so I'll shorten this quite a bit now and say we could follow this story through the 19th century, follow this vernacular historiography and find a whole collection of antiquarians and remarkable people like this man over here, Wesley Greenhill Little. He's a journalist from Newton Ards, whose wife's family has stories of 1798. So he talks to them, and he goes around and collects stories and writes this story, which becomes a local bestseller. Betsy Grail, The Ards of Down, massive bestseller. Described once by a local historian who knew a lot about local history, Aiken McClellan, who was the man behind Coltra, the collections of the Ulster Folk Museum, who used to say that this book was kept in every household in County Down, next to the Bible. So it's that big of a bestseller. But it's a local book. It's not part of the canon of Anglo-Irish literature. I assume it's mentioned in the Cambridge history, but to what extent, Margaret? It's an interesting question here. But it's the way he adapts traditions. Or Francis Joseph Bigger, a Protestant solicitor in Belfast at the end of the 19th century, connected both with Orange men and with nationalists. A remarkable man who sees upon himself to follow in the footsteps of Madden, to write about the northern leaders of the United Irishmen, to collect their traditions, who goes all around Ulster collecting these traditions. All these two remarkable woman over there, Alice Milligan and Esme Carberry, who will publish this radical journal, the Shan Van Vocht, and encourage women specifically to tell their stories. This is amazing things are coming out there. And so we're collecting memory, we're regenerating memory, but at the same time, often when we look at it, it's also being guided and coded. Certain stories are being told, others are not. But it's an interesting question when this happens. Slowly we feel that the restraints are going. Is social forgetting ending here? Is it now becoming social memory? And this is an interesting point. So let's take a few points to dwell on that. We've taken a lot of time. Give me another 8 minutes or so. Could I do that? Eight? Is that too much? All right. All right. I'll rush with eight here quickly. Let's just look at that. Let's stay with Little's book for a minute. So Little's book touches on a lot of people. They hear the story of Betsy Gray, and they're bothered that this story is told about local tradition, but she's not honored, this local heroine. So they decide to make a monument to her. This is commemorating. Till now, there were no monuments. They want to make a monument to her. And they make this monument in advance of the centenary year, a local monument to 1798 to Betsy Gray. So here we are. Social forgetting seems to have ended. Before the centenary celebration happens, the monument is destroyed. It's destroyed by local orange men who fear that Belfast, that Catholics are coming from Belfast on the Sabbath to violate the Presbyterian Sabbath to celebrate a nationalist heroine. So you'd think here that what's happening, and this I call decommemorating, is about stamping out memory. It's not quite. It's much more complicated. By destroying the memory, the monument, they're actually preserving its memory. And more than that, people will remember this moment of how the monument was destroyed. Years later, they'll be able to go back and point to the stones that are there and tell the stories behind them and recount how it is a much more ambivalent event than might be thought. While they destroyed the monument, they kept pieces as souvenirs and kept onto it. It is about owning memory and keeping it privately, not about outsiders coming there and using it for other purposes as they saw it. So it's a remarkable thing. The rails around the monument were turned into horseshoes by a local blacksmith and kept in various homes. The stones were chipped into pieces of the monument and taken away as souvenirs, some going as far as over here to the States and to Canada. So these are relics that people want to hold onto their piece of 98, even though their politics have changed. And so this is how decommemorating, the destruction of monuments, a very hot topic, also in the States, removal and destruction of monuments, is in itself also an act of remembrance, which has a history to itself. And we could be going, I'll skip this bit here and say, what happens in Northern Ireland? After partition, in Northern Ireland, the state has a unionist ethos. You can no longer commemorate in any form the United Irishmen. It's politically incorrect for a long time. But there'll always be silence breakers. There'll always be people who break the silence. There'll always be people who speak out. So you can look at the remarkable work of people like the poet John Hewitt, or Seamus Heaney, or the poet, or Sam Hannah Bell, the novelist, who've all commented on this issue. But even here for a minute, I want to say something. This is interesting. All these people spoke out about traditions of 98, but they were all engaged in some way or other with social forgetting. Take John Hewitt. The man wrote his MA thesis on Weaver poets, and he knew they had a lot of poetry on 1798 and on the turnout. He knew it well, but he ends his thesis in 1790, so it won't be too political. He doesn't publish this in his work. When he publishes it, he keeps it elsewhere. He throws hints at different places. He writes a play about the rebellion and about the McCrackens. Throughout his whole life, he doesn't publish that play. Only years later, the John Hewitt School uncovers it and reads it out. Never been staged. Seamus Heaney is often associated with Requiem for a Croppies. He grew up on these traditions of 1798 locally. And yet, Requiem for a Croppies is about Wexford. It's not about Ulster. Now, he writes poetry about Henry Monroe and the rebels in County Down. Can't bring himself to publish them. In the end, he puts some of them into a radio play. The play is played once on BBC. Nobody recalls it since then. Wasn't reviewed. No coverage of it. Monroe. So it's interesting. This is not the prominent Shaheeny that we know. There's other poems behind it. This is part of social forgetting. Go the same with all of them as we keep going. So I'll end with the last bit here. So when does social forgetting end? We've seen this history, and I follow this over time. When can it finally emerge into the open? Maybe at a certain time it's politically no longer a problem anymore. This is what is thought to have happened in 1998. In 1998, the time of the bicentenary, which coincided with the Good Friday Agreement, it was seen as a moment where everything can come out into open, where Presbyterians can finally commemorate 1798. See, here we have a mural in Ballinahinch of Betsy Gray and the Battle of Ballinahinch. It's all out there in a mural. So now memory is out there. And yet, Social forgetting, just like social memory, has traditions of its own, and it's far more tenacious and deeper than we think. We've now got a few years of distance since the Bicentennial. A lot of said about the Bicentennial, how forgetting has ended, and now we're all in an age of memory, and we can all celebrate memory. We were there. We saw it there. I mean, Kevin would have seen it. Margaret was there. Everybody who saw it, saw this kind of rhetoric. We were exposed to it. I was a student at the time. Well, take this mural, for example. It wasn't really a mural. It was a canvas painting stuck on a wall. So within a year, it deteriorated and disappeared. It's no longer there. No monuments were set up in the north, in Northern Ireland. For 1798, prominent ones. There were plaques in different places. And that's a story into itself as well. So if you want to look at plaques, for example, I'll skip this one. William Orr, the proto-martyr, a phrase throughout republicanism, throughout time, remember Orr, remember Orr. Time and time again, his grave, remember Orr, you go there, it's a family grave, doesn't even list his name. Social forgetting, you don't write the name. People know where the grave is, but you don't write it. In 1998, finally, a plaque is put for William Orr, but it's a small, little, modest plaque. It's not a monument to William Orr. Over there. Or to give one last example, just to show how social forgetting keeps returning when you least expect it. So a few years ago, just as I'm about to finish the book, I've been working on it for more than 10 years by this stage, and I'm giving a talk in England about the book as it's developing. And I open the news, and I hear that in the cemetery of Mullusk, in Antrim, they set up a plaque, a blue plaque, one of these commemorative heritage plaques, to Jemmy Hope, the working class hero I talked about before. And it's right out there in the open. You know, social forgetting has ended now. The community is willing to embrace Jemmy Hope. This is what happened within 2 weeks. That's decommemorating for you. Not completely removed. It's still there, but it's there in a broken form. So people talked about vandalism, and this was just the work of, you know, ignoramuses who know nothing. I'm not sure. There's something deep going on there. And so that, in a nutshell, is a brief example of a case study of social forgetting. Thank you.